Christians throughout the Middle East are persecuted for their faith. But now, for the first time, a Christian organization is tracking all of it with a database. What does that mean for our persecuted brothers and sisters? How can average people like you and me use it to raise awareness? That's our focus this week. Welcome to The Land and the Book, where we're about to give you an update on all the top headlines from the Middle East. Our host is noted Israel scholar Dr. Charlie Dyer, and I'm John Gager. Along with our wives, we have just returned from Israel. Charlie, what an experience to meet with folks who have gone through so much and hear all those firsthand accounts.
I agree, John. It's a sobering experience, but also encouraging to see what Israel has been doing and where things seem to be going for the future.
Well, speaking of the future, those many conversations that we recorded are going to be part of an upcoming one-hour special you'll hear more about. All right, Passover will soon be upon us, and one of the traditional Passover questions is, what makes this night different from all others? Passover is an important biblical holiday that has great meaning for both Jewish people and believers in Jesus. So I think this is an important question to ask, Charlie.
It is, John. And if you want to learn more about what makes Passover so special, well, our friends at Life in Messiah are offering to mail you a free copy of their Messianic Passover Haggadah. The booklet will lead you through the celebration of Passover to see the rich connections to Jesus, our Messiah, and to the Last Supper. You'll also receive a link for an interactive Passover Seder video. With the Haggadah and video, you can celebrate Passover this year with your family and friends. Now, to get this free offer, just go to lifeinmessiah.org and click on the Moody Radio button to find out more and request your copy. That's lifeinmessiah.org.
And now a look at current events, stories based in the Middle East that have been unfolding all week long. This coming week is the start of Ramadan, which often signals a time of heightened tension between Israel and the Palestinians. What can Israel do to help calm the situation?
You know, if you listen to most of the world, they would say all Israel needs to do is end the war with Hamas, get out of Gaza, lower tensions with Hezbollah, and that would calm everything. Sadly, that's not supported by recent history. There have been conflicts at Ramadan long before the current war in Gaza. In 2021, an 11-day conflict between Israel and Hamas broke out over an Israeli raid on the Temple Mount following a disturbance up there during Ramadan. In 2023, just a year ago, Ramadan coincided with Passover, and there were conflicts on successive days as stones were thrown from the Temple Mount down on the Western Wall Plaza where Jews had gathered to pray. There's always tension during Ramadan, especially following Friday prayers. So what can Israel do to help de-escalate the situation? Well, two approaches have been suggested, and they're mutually exclusive. The first is that of the National Security Minister, Ben-Gvir, who suggested limiting Arab-Israeli access to the site to worshipers over the age of 70. The other approach, proposed by the head of Israel's security services, is to not limit access to the site. He believes limiting access will turn the Gaza war into a Jewish-Muslim fight rather than an Israeli-Hamas conflict, and that just plays into the hands of Hamas. Prime Minister Netanyahu asked different cabinet members to provide options for age criteria or other quotas for Israeli citizens. The real problem is that Ramadan and the Temple Mount are religious issues. It's no accident that Hamas named their October 7 attack the Al-Aqsa Flood. A recent UN report said Al-Qaeda is changing its messaging since October 7 to focus on the so-called sanctity of the Al-Aqsa Mosque as a way to help restore its credibility. Watch for Israel to look for a way to limit the size of the crowds, especially young males, while still trying to maintain a low profile. Also, watch to see what they can do to restrain the more extreme right-wing Jewish element who would like to use the time to push for greater Israeli control over the area. This next month will be a sensitive time. Just pray that the leadership there has great wisdom and that cooler heads prevail.
Well, speaking of the Temple Mount, a recent archaeological discovery hints at a Christian presence at the site prior to the building of the Dome of the Rock and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Tell us about this discovery.
Yeah, this is fascinating. It's a somewhat unexpected find. Most assume the Temple Mount remained an unoccupied ruin between its destruction by the Romans in AD 70 and the building of the Dome of the Rock and Al-Aqsa Mosque about 600 years later. But two recently discovered Byzantine-era weights suggest there was a Christian presence on the Temple Mount sometime during that period. The Temple Mount Sifting Project, which for the past 20 years has been sifting dirt discarded from the mount when the Muslims built an underground mosque, are the ones who made this discovery. The two small objects each weighed just 0.02 of an ounce. That's half the weight of a paperclip. So these are small discoveries. One was made of glass, the other was made of brass. They're likely official imperial weights that were required to be present in major churches. These and other objects discovered suggest a Byzantine church might have stood on the site prior to the Islamic invasion. Now, since no excavation is allowed up on the site, we can't know for sure, but this find, small as it is, does raise that intriguing possibility.
If you're joining us midstream, this is The Land and the Book from Moody Radio, a one-hour flyover of the Middle East. In this opening segment, our host, Dr. Charlie Dyer, noted Israel scholar and author, works us through a list of current event stories. I'm John Gager, and Charlie, Egypt is struggling financially, and apparently they are selling off historical assets to generate cash as they plunge ever deeper into debt. What's been happening, and why is it so concerning?
Well, Egypt has been experiencing rising inflation. They've taken austerity measures to help combat the problem, but the impact on the day-to-day lives of most Egyptians has been very difficult. The country is now the second largest debtor nation to the International Monetary Fund. To generate cash, Egypt has been selling off some of its most significant properties, especially its grandest hotels. The Mena House Hotel is one of the properties that's been sold. It sits by the pyramids. It's hosted guests like Winston Churchill. It's an incredible property. Another hotel is the Old Cataract Hotel in Aswan. I've stayed there, John. It's one of the most luxurious hotels I've ever seen. Concerning part of these sales is that once the funds have been spent, the asset's gone. Now, all isn't doom and gloom for Egypt. There are some positive investments being made in the country. Recently, the United Arab Emirates unveiled a major energy pipeline project to link Egypt to Europe and generate income for Egypt. And a group of Turkish investors are entering the Egyptian spinning, weaving, and clothing sector to take advantage of Egypt's low-cost labor. They hope to provide 70,000 direct jobs and an additional 100,000 indirect jobs, which would help the Egyptian economy. Egypt also signed a multi-billion dollar deal with Gulf State investors to build a state-of-the-art city west of Alexandria. Construction would pump billions into the economy immediately, with the hope that the new city will then attract business investment and tourism once it's completed. The real question now is if Egypt can get some of these projects up and running before the country runs out of cash or things to sell to keep its economy afloat.
Wow, that's an interesting conundrum there for sure. Egypt's economy might be struggling, but archaeologists there continue to strike it rich in their search for historical treasures. What's the latest on the discovery of a tunnel that might lead to the tomb of Queen Cleopatra? I'm really intrigued here, Charlie.
I am too, John, and this story, as intriguing as it is, left me, though, with just a little bit of a taste for more at the end. I'll explain why here in a second. You know, it's just when you think most major archaeological finds have been made that a report like this comes along. An archaeologist from the Dominican Republic excavating in Egypt has come across a tunnel. It's over 40 feet underground. Now, the tunnel's carved into sandstone, and it's actually over 3/4 of a mile long. The purpose of the tunnel, it's not yet known, and part of it is still submerged in water because it's right up north near the Mediterranean. It was discovered in connection with a temple dedicated to Osiris, the god of death. Cleopatra tried to identify herself with Isis, the mythological sister and wife of Osiris. Sculptures of Isis, along with coins depicting the names and likeness of Cleopatra and Alexander the Great, have been found at the site. Now, it's located west of Alexandria, right by the Mediterranean Sea, as I mentioned. But the questions that still need to be answered and that weren't answered so far in this article, why was the tunnel built? Where does it lead? And is it connected somehow to the still undiscovered tomb of Cleopatra? Now, having raised the issues, they didn't provide the answers that I was looking for, but hopefully those answers will come to light as the dig progresses.
Christians throughout the Middle East are persecuted for their faith, but now, for the first time, a Christian organization is tracking all of it with a database. What does that mean for our persecuted brothers and sisters? That's a conversation we're going to be having next on The Land and the Book. Charlie, how can listeners support this ministry with a letter to this station, an email? Why is that such a big deal?
Well, stations are constantly being given opportunities for other programs, new opportunities, and they need to look and say, what programs are meeting the needs of our listeners? And so if they don't hear from somebody, they don't know. But if a listener writes to the station and says, yes, I'm listening to this program, I love this program, that's a data point for the station to say, yeah, we should keep this program up and running.
All of that to say, if you've never taken the opportunity to let this station know how you appreciate this program, would you think about doing that today? A quick email, a phone call, a text, a postcard, anything you got that would make a statement that says, hey, we appreciate your carving out airtime for the land and the book. Boy, we'd sure be grateful. A conversation about a persecution database is next here on The Land and the Book. Discrimination and violence is nothing new for Christians around the world. As believers, we're promised troubles in this life. But is persecution a static thing? Or are some areas kind of stepping up their hatred toward Christians? One organization has begun a database to keep track of it all, and we'll let you take a look at that next. Welcome back to The Land and the Book from Moody Radio. I'm John Gager, here to share a quick idea first on sharing Christ with your Muslim friend or neighbor. Listen to this. You ever wonder what the Bible is referring to when it talks about Israel's spiritual blindness? Let's ask Wes Tabor, who's an ambassador with Life in Messiah. What do we mean by that?
Well, all non-believers are blinded by Satan, John. 2 Corinthians 4 says, but even if our gospel is veiled, it is veiled to those who are perishing, whose minds the God of this age has blinded. Mm-hmm. But God also judicially blinded rebellious Israel. You know, back in Isaiah 6, 2 Corinthians 3:15 says that there's a veil on their hearts when the Torah is read. Mm. And Paul says in Romans, this blindness is both partial and temporary.
So in light of this spiritual blindness, what can we as believers do?
Well, pray. Pray for the veil to be removed and for God's Spirit to enliven the truth. Paul prays in Ephesians 1, I pray that the eyes of your heart may be enlightened. Verse 18.
What a great prayer. May the eyes of your heart be enlightened. That's Wes Tabor with Life in Messiah. Dr. David Curry is CEO of Global Christian Relief, America's leading watchdog organization focused on the plight of persecuted Christians worldwide. In addition to equipping the Western Church to advocate and pray for the persecuted, GCR works in the most restrictive countries to protect and encourage Christians threatened by faith-based discrimination and violence. Dr. Curry currently serves on the United States Commission on Religious Freedom, and we want to say welcome to The Land of the Book, Dr. Curry.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me on, John.
Now, some would say, boy, you guys are biting off a mighty big bite with this database. How do you intend to keep it all updated?
Well, we're working with the Institute for International Religious Freedom, who have just great researchers. They have, you know, been in this field for a long time. And of course, we have massive experience over 50 years as an organization working in these most contested areas where the persecution of faith is its most intense. And people say, well, where would that be? North Korea, Somalia, Iran, Iraq, some of these places that we hear about in the news where extremists and or governments are targeting Christians and their faith. What this index does that's different, however, is it really measures all violent incidents and incidents of persecution against any faith. And I tell you why that's important, John, because for over a decade, I've been reporting on violence against Christians, but there's no context for it. And they get questions over and over again. What does that mean compared to what? And this index will measure all incidents, whether it's anti-Semitism against Jews or violence against Christians or others. So you're going to have a context, ability as the database grows to really see religious freedom as a whole. And I think at that point, people are really going to understand how massive the persecution and targeting of Christians has been and is right now.
So how do these reports of persecution actually reach you? How do you get the information?
Well, this database is of all publicly verified incidents. And what that means is it's limited in that it will always be a baseline number. It's not going to be the complete number. We have lots of information of things that we believe has happened, but but hasn't been validated. And that's intentional, because when you have publicly validated information, whether that's in a news source or it's from some other way, the United Nations or other governments that have validated these attacks, the data is unassailable. So up until now, everybody's sort of in their own category. Somebody's talking about anti-Semitism, and people could say, oh, that never really happened. Or people would say, oh, the persecution of Christians isn't as big as you say in your list that only talks about Christians. These numbers are unassailable. They have been validated 2, 3, 4, 5 different ways. So you could see the volume and the scale of this problem. For example, in India, you've had over 62,000 Christians and some Muslims who have been displaced in the last year, because extremist Hindus who have a nationalist agenda, they're tied to, this is the militant arm of the Indian government, has attacked Christian communities in Manipur, in another district called Chhattisgarh, and in other regions. So the Indian government denies it, or they don't want to talk about it. They don't want to say that they're part of it. But this is unassailable data, and people have to deal with that. And it has political ramifications. But I also think, John, this is meant to wake up the church. My heart is that the church stand with persecuted believers, that we rally around them, that we understand that one of the tactics of the devil is to use violence to make people flee from their faith. And it works in some cases. And so if you want to strengthen the church, you have to start with serving the persecuted, praying for them, understanding their needs, and trying to find a way to strengthen the church and to stand with it.
Thanks for joining us today on The Land and the Book. I'm John Gager with our guest, Dr. David Curry of Global Christian Relief. Let's swing our focus toward the Middle East. That's, of course, our heart here at The Land and the Book. Name some hot spots that you're tracking right now in that region that kind of pop up when you think about this country or that country.
Well, obviously, the rise of anti-Semitism, or really the revealing of it from the October attacks, is noted in the database, and there's more data being added all the time on the subject. One region that I think sort of falls below the radar for a lot of people is Armenia and the ongoing struggle that is happening there between Azerbaijan and Armenia. And it's not just a national problem. This is a Christian country, has been a Christian country, one of the first. If they would claim they were the first Christian country to identify to say we are a Christian country back in, you know, many decades ago. I think it's 894 or something like that, AD. So they have been a Christian country, people practicing their Christian faith. In the last few months, you've had 120,000 Armenian Christians who have been forcibly removed from their homes by the Azerbaijan government. And the Christian heritage there, again, centuries old, has been deleted, destroying churches, destroying Christian landmarks, in order to sort of prove in their mind that this has always been Muslim territory and to force people into that faith. And it's tragic, and it's not on anybody's radar. 120,000 Christians removed from their homes, and now they're stateless because technically they were Azerbaijan citizens. But now they've been forced into Armenia, and they've been welcomed by Armenia, but they're not Armenian citizens. So, I mean, there's just a lot going on there, and this is the targeting of Christians in the Middle East. Armenia is just above Iran. It should be a partner with Israel, but they haven't been welcomed there yet either. So there's a lot going on there. This is the sort of thing that's revealed in the data that you could see compared to what else is going on. That is a major story that most people don't know about.
Dr. David Curry is CEO of Global Christian Relief, a watchdog organization focused on the plight of persecuted Christians worldwide. He joins us today on The Land and the Book. I'm John Gager saying thanks for your company. All right, what are some common forms of persecution that believers experience in the Middle East? What are we talking about here?
Well, I think, first of all, we have to understand the index that we released in January is a violence index. In spring, around Easter, we're going to release index that measures other factors. When we measure persecution, what we're looking at is, does the government doing the persecution? Is the persecution within the family? When you're talking about in the Middle East, a lot of people who are coming to faith from a Muslim background, And within that structure, some extremists interpret Muslim theology to say that anybody who leaves, and not even extremists, many people across it would say anybody who leaves the Muslim faith is an infidel. Extremists would say that gives them the right to kill them, to rape them, to beat them. And sometimes that happens, where people come to faith from a Muslim background and they're disassociated from their family. They can lose their job. And you see this amongst Palestinian Christians who are really struggling because they're denied, you know, a kind of understanding from the Muslim community in Palestine, and they don't fit within the Israeli context. And so they just feel left out of place. But they're believers in Jesus, that redeeming story, the death, burial, resurrection of Jesus that transformed their life, but they come from a Muslim background, and it's really hard for them. So that's a church within the Middle East, Muslim background believers that most people don't realize. Millions of people now who have come to Christ, many times miraculously, who are living there within the Middle East, and they face every kind of persecution, including martyrdom.
So the obvious question is, why do so many of these stories, and there are, as you say, so many of them, why do they fail to make it into our media coverage in the West?
Well, I thank God for programs like yours and others that do talk about it. I think we have so many distractions here. Your social media feed is going to be filled with stories of difficulty. And so we can become overwhelmed. It can become fatigue. What I think we have to understand is that this is a biblical calling that's talked about in Hebrews and elsewhere, where we're to care for, pray for those who are in chains, it says, for the name of Jesus, as if it were your own family, as if it were yourself. And this is the key. That's the sentence. It is your family. And so I think we lack an understanding. Part of my calling is to wake up the church and say, this gentleman here, whose name may be Muhammad, he may have come from a Muslim background, but he is a follower of Jesus. Therefore, he is your brother. We need to care. It seems like we believe somehow, maybe not intentionally, that there's a distance between where they're at and where we're at. But here's the challenge, John, and I think you know this. I hope your listeners know this. Persecution and intolerance of Christians is growing here too. Mm-hmm. And the spiritual lessons that these people go through, because they're strong, and even in the midst of it, joyful in many cases, is the lessons we have to learn. How do you practice your faith? How does it become violent when it is opposed, when you're discriminated, when you lose everything? Is he still enough? And these are key spiritual questions. And that's part of why one of my key elements is to post stories on our website, globalchristianrelief.org, videos, stories of transformation, of inspiration. And yes, in difficult circumstances, but it's still powerful. And in an odd way that only happens in the spirit, really, it is inspiring.
You know, I think listeners are saying, back to this database of religious violence, who has access to that? Is it restricted to members of the media? How would we get to that database?
You can go on there and you can say, what's happening in Azerbaijan, attacks against Christians. You can select the faith that you want to target as far as understanding what's going on. Here's a great question that you can punch in. There's fields that you fill out and say, closed churches. How many churches were closed last year? Where were the most churches closed? And I would just ask that of your listeners. Do you know what country closed the most churches? The answer, Nicaragua.
Hmm.
Wouldn't have thought of that.
No.
179 churches were closed. And that's because Daniel Ortega and his administration is targeting Catholic and evangelical churches. He sees them as a threat to his power. He's a communist. In every communist country, there's some form of targeting of Christians, and they have been closing churches, arresting priests, arresting pastors who stand up to the government. They just released 18 priests yesterday, sent them back to Rome, but they had been held in detention, including a major Bishop Alvarez, for many months. And all they were doing is practicing their faith, but they didn't go along with the communist dogma that said that was preeminent. That's the challenge within communism, that system has to be preeminent. Nothing else can stand up to it, not Jesus, not anybody. That's the same problem that China has with Christianity, that they don't want any theology, idea, person above their communist ideology. And so Nicaragua is closing a lot of churches right now. You can just go in and select these fields and say, you know, where were the most people arrested? Where were the most people abducted for their faith? And again, these are baseline numbers. You will see, for example, in Nigeria, over 5,800 people were abducted because they were Christians. And just all kinds of interesting tidbits. Anybody can access it. Our website, Global Christian Relief, is a portal that you can go see what's happening there. And researchers, I'm hoping, will go, and policymakers, and really dig into it.
We'll link to your website, Global Christian Relief, when you visit our website, thelandandthebook.org. Our time is gone, but we really appreciate, Dr. Curry, your opening our eyes to all of this, persecution worldwide and persecution in particular in the Middle East. Thank you for your expertise and for your devotion to this cause.
Thank you, John. Appreciate your show.
Up next on The Land of the Book, it's Bible Questions and Answers with Dr. Charlie Dyer, our host. He's back right after this. You know, let's face it, you have so many choices in what you listen to these days and how you listen. The fact that you're with us, man, we count that an honor, and we want to say thank you for being a part of The Land and the Book. I'm John Gager. Seated across from me is Charlie Dyer, and right at his side is his Bible, which he's going to need because your questions are fast and furious, and they're always about the Bible. I'm looking forward to those. First, though, Passover. Soon going to be upon us. And one of the traditional Passover questions is, what makes this night different from all others? Could you answer that? Passover is an important biblical holiday that has great meaning for both Jewish people and believers in Jesus. So I'm thinking this is a great question to ask, Charlie.
It is a great question. And if you want to learn more about what makes Passover so special, our friends at Life in Messiah are offering to mail you a free copy of their Messianic Passover Haggadah. The booklet will lead you through the celebration of Passover to see the rich connections to Jesus, our Messiah, and the Last Supper. You'll also receive a link for an interactive Passover Seder video. With the Haggadah and video, you can celebrate Passover this year with your family and friends. To get this free offer, just go to lifeinmessiah.org and click on the Moody Radio button to find out more and request your copy. That's lifeinmessiah.org.
Questions and answers, that's now on The Land and the Book, starting with Terry, who asks, how would you define Christ's kingdom as it's mentioned in Matthew 6:10, the traditional Lord's Prayer?
Well, I believe the kingdom being described by Christ is the millennial kingdom or the messianic kingdom predicted in the Old Testament. The prophets described a coming kingdom era when the Messiah would come to rule over the world from Jerusalem. In that model prayer Jesus gave in Matthew 6, I see two phrases that are used side by side to help provide the explanation. The first is the phrase, thy kingdom come. But then Jesus explains what he means in the next phrase, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. When the kingdom arrives, God's rule over the earth will match his rule in heaven. And ultimately, that awaits the arrival of Jesus back to earth as King of Kings and Lord of Lords.
Nikki asks, how do we explain how so many pastors fall into scandal, especially sexual sin? I'm looking for scripture that explains how Satan manifests himself in our lives when we're weak or double-minded. What do you think?
Well, I think there's several passages. In fact, I would like to focus not only on the problem, but the solution. And the passage I go to is Ephesians 6, verses 10 to 18. You know, Paul there describes the armor of God, and he tells us to put it on so we can take our stand against the devil's schemes. It's interesting. Satan has more schemes than, when I grew up, they would say, than Carter has pills. So rather than focusing on his schemes, let's focus on what God's armor is. And first part of it's defensive in nature. He starts with godly character. It's the first defense. We're to wear the belt of truth and the breastplate of righteousness and be ready to share the gospel, God's good news about Jesus. We're also to carry the shield of faith, our conscious choice decision to believe what God has said in spite of Satan trying to sow seeds of doubt in our mind. And the helmet of salvation, well, that's God's protection over us. No matter what, God has guaranteed the salvation of those who've placed their trust in him. But I love it. Paul ends with two offensive weapons we have to defeat Satan, the sword of the Spirit, which is the word of God, and prayer. When Jesus was tempted in the wilderness, he used the word of God to defeat Satan's attacks. And in the Garden of Gethsemane, he told the disciples to watch and pray that you enter not into temptation. So I believe the confession of sin is an important part, but the Word of God and the power of the Spirit and prayer are the two big things. Now, one final item. We're called on to resist the devil in Ephesians 6 and also in James 4, and we do it primarily through prayer and the Word of God, but there is one other exception. When it comes to sexual temptation, which you also mentioned, we're told to flee rather than to try and stand and oppose it on our own. You know, Paul told the people in Corinth to flee immorality. He told Timothy to flee youthful lusts. And we should be more like Joseph. Remember when he was tempted by Potiphar's wife? The best way to avoid sexual sin is to put as much distance between you and it as possible.
That's Charlie Dyer. I'm John Gager. This is The Land and the Book, Questions and Answers. David says while visiting a Greek Orthodox church, the bishop there said that Joseph never had sexual relations with Mary. I know that Jesus' brothers and sisters are mentioned by name in the book of Matthew. Our nephew, who is of this denomination, said the tradition states that Joseph was old and already had children from a previous marriage when Jesus was born. This is like the Catholic belief that Mary was a perpetual virgin. I believe that she was a virgin before Jesus' birth, but afterwards had a natural sexual relationship. What do you think?
Well, there's nothing in the Bible which states or suggests that Mary remained a perpetual virgin. That is later church tradition. There's also no biblical evidence to suggest Joseph was substantially older than Mary or that he had children from a previous marriage. Those are all attempts to, quote, protect the chastity of Mary while trying to explain why the Bible also says Jesus had brothers and sisters. So I believe Matthew 1:25 strongly suggests Mary and Joseph had sexual relations following Jesus' birth. It literally says Joseph did not know her, that is in a sexual sense, until she gave birth to a son. The implication is that Joseph did begin having sexual relations with his wife following Jesus' birth.
Another question from David, who says the pastor at this Greek Orthodox church said that the Church of Jacob's Well, where Jesus met the Samaritan woman mentioned in John 4, had a caretaker who had been murdered by Zionists. He said that now there's another caretaker at the site. What is the truth, though? How can this use of the word Zionist refer to anti-Semitism?
Well, the event to which the priest is referring isn't something recent. It actually took place back in 1979. That's 45 years ago. The priest at Jacob's Well wasn't murdered by Zionists. He was murdered by a mentally unbalanced Jewish man. The same man also killed a Jewish gynecologist in Tel Aviv and a family in Lod, and he attacked a nun at Jacob's Well at a later date. But all those attacks were by a single individual against both Jewish and Christian Arab victims. It wasn't a Zionist plot against Christians or Palestinians. Now, the cleric who replaced the one who was murdered and who eventually helped capture the assailant, he verified the assailant was one individual whom he identified as a madman. Now, I think what makes this story anti-Semitic is that it's been expanded and embellished over time so that that one mentally disturbed man became a group of fanatical Zionists who supposedly used a hatchet to display the sign of the cross on the priest's body and plucked out his eyes and chopped off three fingers to make him renounce his Orthodox faith. Now, those added details parallel some of the medieval charges made against Jews and were designed to inflame Christians into seeking retribution. And that's why I believe the inclusion of those details is what crosses over the line into anti-Semitism. A best defense against something like that is online ability now. Go back and try and find the original factual accounts of what happened and then see what was altered to vilify a specific group that had no real connection to the event itself. And that's what happened in the later accounts of this event, which really did happen back in 1979.
A question from Brian. The Bible teaches us that God formed us in the womb. This seems to indicate that abortion would be homicide. At the same time, I wonder if God would allow any exceptions, such as in the case of rape or incest or to save the mother's life. Your thoughts?
Yeah, and I'm going to wade in here and probably be hit on all sides. That's okay. But I do appreciate, Brian, your stand on protecting the lives of the unborn. And I understand the concerns when it comes to sensitivity toward those possible exceptions. Now, here's what I would say. I still see the issue in it all being the life of the unborn child. Though a horrible deed was committed, it doesn't seem right to me to impose the death penalty on the child in the womb for something that he or she didn't do. Those guilty of the crime ought to be punished, but that unborn child is still precious in God's eyes. Now, the issue of requiring an abortion to preserve the life of the mother is slightly different, but what I suspect is that the number of times where this might actually be the case are extremely rare. Dr. John Walvoord was president of Dallas Seminary for years, and he told the story of how his mother was told she needed to have an abortion to save her life. She refused, and both mother and child lived, and he was that unborn child. There are many options now available to help protect the lives of both the mother and the unborn child, and I suspect this is used more as a theoretical excuse than an actual life and death situation. If the mother's committed to giving birth to the child, I believe that in most every case, her desire can be accomplished. The bottom line for me is that an unborn child is a human life, and if we accept that premise, then it changes how we approach these exceptional situations. We would no more kill an unborn child who was born as the result of rape or incest than we would kill a child already born who was the result of rape or incest. So I still think the child's life is the most precious.
A question from Nancy about Queen Esther's banquet. In the Bible, it states the banquet was of wine. Can you please clarify for me, was it just wine or was it with food also? Thank you.
Yeah, I'll start with this. The Persians were known for banquets that included a lot of drinking, even using elaborate wine goblets. But I believe the feasts that are there included food, and I say that for several reasons. First, 12 times in the book, it uses the word banquet, and while that included the focus on drinking, it would also include exotic foods. In Esther 1:3-5, the length of the first banquet was 180 days, followed immediately by another 7-day banquet. And that suggests to me that they were doing more than just drinking wine. You know, half a year of just wine and no food, that's hard to believe. So I think the food was there. And then also in 1:9, the original Queen Vashti gave a banquet for the women in the palace, which doesn't mention wine. So anyway, because of the use of the term banquet, I believe there's eating and drinking wine at these different events. The wine was used because it indicated extravagance in the event. It'd be kind of like, pardon the expression on this, it'd be like someone at a modern wedding reception saying it's going to feature an open bar. So there's food, but lots of drink. And that's what was being said there and what the king was doing.
Boy, it's been great getting all these questions in. Yours is welcome anytime with an email to thelandandthebook@moody.edu. Charlie Dyer's devotional is next, right here on The Land and the Book. So last Christmas, somebody gave me an emergency kit that featured, among other things, a light, a knife, and a fire-starting piece of flint. I have yet to try that flint. Hi, I'm John Gager. This is The Land and the Book, where Dr. Charlie Dyer, our host, is continuing his devotional series, Objects on My Shelf. Now, Charlie, I've seen that shelf of yours. You've got plenty of material for devotionals, but among those objects, apparently a piece of flint?
Multiple pieces of flint.
Okay, I'm looking forward to seeing what you do with that in your devotional right after this Holy Land Experience testimony.
I'm Heather, and one of the many things that I've been struck by is Charlie has not wasted one inch of real estate in this entire country. We have learned so much about the history of Israel, the people of Israel. He has taken the content of Scripture, put it into the context of the cultures. He's helped us understand the cultures and has brought us into the modern day problems. And I think what it's done for me is it's changed me dramatically, but it has also given me a resolve to be the kind of believer I need to be for Israel.
All right, Charlie. I know nothing about flint other than that I own a piece of it. I'm looking forward to your devotional.
Oh, thanks, John. Well, everybody, welcome back to my office. I hope you're enjoying this 3-week series focusing on objects I keep on display here on one of my office shelves. Today, I want to show you 6 relatively small stones that I keep next to that piece of salt I showed you last week. And no, these aren't stones from the Elah Valley, where David fought Goliath, though I also have a rock that I picked up there. The rocks I want to show you today come from the Judean wilderness, which happens to be my favorite spot in Israel. These rocks aren't the typical limestone or chalk or even basalt rocks that one normally sees in Israel. These 6 all have something of a glossy sheen and relatively straight edges, and their color is a mixture of black, brown, and gray. The 3 larger pieces have a thin layer of chalky limestone attached. I must be hungry because one of them reminds me of a brownie, a very thin brownie with a light tan marshmallow-like topping on top. The smaller pieces have jagged, almost razor-sharp edges. One even looks like it would make an excellent arrowhead. So what are these rocks? Well, depending on who you talk to, they're referred to as flint or chert. Flint is a variety of chert. Flint's usually black or dark gray, while chert can come in a combination of shades. Of the six pieces on my shelf, one definitely appears to be flint, while the other five might be classified as chert, but it really doesn't matter, since apart from color, the stones share the same basic properties. Both flint and chert are a type of quartz, which is why these rocks appear somewhat glossy, and when they're split, these rocks form edges similar in appearance to broken glass. Flint and chert are both hard enough to incise scratches on a glass bottle, and they can be found embedded in limestone and chalk. As those rocks weather down, the flint remains and ends up scattered along the top of the ground. I picked up all these pieces while walking in the Judean wilderness. Now that I've shown you the rocks, let's head to the area in the wilderness where I found them. As our bus stops, follow me up the hillside just to our left. It's a bit of a walk, so take your time and pace yourself. A good way to do that is to look down at the rocks along the pathway. There are many pieces of white limestone or chalk, but look for the dark rocks scattered among them. Some are quite large, but focus on the smaller pieces. You know, the ones that'll fit into your suitcase without putting you over that 50-pound limit for your flight home. Now, we've reached the top, and we're looking into the Wadi Kilt. It's one of those, oh, wow, experiences in Israel. But before you get distracted, let's look more closely at the rocks you collected on the way up. Now, I see lots of brown, gray, and even black flint and chert. Some's embedded in a layer of chalk, but other pieces are not. Now, turn them over in your hand and let the sun reflect off them. Notice the sharp edges and the glossy sheen. You can also see the hardness of the flint, especially if it's attached to a piece of limestone or chalk. That side produces a chalky residue when you rub your fingers over it, but the flint is hard. It doesn't come off when you rub it in your fingers. You now have an interesting and absolutely free souvenir to take home with you to put on your shelf. But let me add a biblical connection to make it even more significant. The Bible uses several words for flint, and it also pictures several uses for this hard stone. In Exodus 4 and Joshua 5, knives were made from flint and were used to circumcise Moses' son and the children of Israel. Now, depending on the piece you picked up, you might even be able to imagine using its sharp edge as a knife. Limestone might seem hard, but it's not impervious. Water can seep through it, but flint is impervious to water. When Moses struck the rock in the wilderness in Exodus 17, I always imagined him striking a large piece of limestone, which broke open to allow water to flow out. But in Deuteronomy 9:15, Moses says, God brought water for you out of the rock of flint. And in the last verse of Psalm 114, the psalmist also said God turned the rock into a pool of water, the flint into a fountain of water. Two different words are used in those verses, but both refer to flint. Moses split a large flint rock that would normally resist being split in two by a mere wooden staff, and God brought water from a rock never associated with natural springs. But perhaps the greatest use of flint in the Bible, both for good and for evil, is its use to describe stern, hard determination. In Zechariah 7, God summarized why the nation of Judah went into captivity. He sent them into captivity because the people had hardened their hearts and refused to respond to his message. God says it in this way, "They made their hearts as hard as flint and would not listen to the law or the words that the Lord Almighty had sent by his Spirit through the earlier prophets." They hardened their hearts until they were as impervious to God's word as a piece of flint is to water. They became hard and unyielding. But the hardness of flint is also used in the Bible as a positive illustration. Isaiah used flint to describe the resolute decision of the servant of the Lord, a prophetic picture of Jesus, to remain true in spite of opposition. Listen to what he says in Isaiah 50, verses 6 and 7. "I offered my back to those who beat me, my cheek to those who pulled out my beard. I did not hide my face from mocking and spitting. Because the sovereign Lord helps me, I will not be disgraced. Therefore, I have set my face like flint, and I know I will not be put to shame." If you want to know how resolute and determined Jesus was to endure persecution at the time of his crucifixion, squeeze that piece of flint. But the same kind of determination and fortitude that Jesus demonstrated has also been made available by God to his followers. How do I know this? Listen to God's promise to Ezekiel when he called him as a prophet to a rebellious nation about to be judged. I will make your forehead like the hardest stone, harder than flint. Do not be afraid of them or terrified by them, though they are a rebellious house. Whatever opposition Ezekiel was about to face, and he faced much, God promised to strengthen and protect him, to make him harder than flint. It's time to head back from the Judean wilderness to my office and to say our goodbyes. But before you go, take one last look at that piece of flint in your hand and there on my shelf. And then think about how God used these rocks to illustrate his truth in the Bible. Water gushing from flint struck by a wooden stick? That's definitely a miracle. The hardness of flint to illustrate determination? Hold a piece of flint in your hand, and that makes perfect sense. It pictures the determination of the servant, Jesus, who willingly suffered and died to pay the penalty for our sin. Sadly, it can also picture the determination of those in sin to continue refusing to listen to God's warning of impending judgment. And finally, it can serve as a reminder to us that God will give us the strength and ability to stand firm for him, even in times of trouble. So what do you see when you look at that piece of flint? Hopefully, it's not a graphic reminder of a heart hardened against God. How about an illustration of how God can cause living water to flow from something as hard as flint? And he demonstrated that by having his own son have a flint-like determination to suffer and die to pay the penalty for our sin so we can experience God's forgiveness. And finally, if we turn to God, he'll give us the strength and hardness of flint to allow us to stand firm for him. Flint, just one kind of stone, but with many applications.
Thank you, Charlie. And maybe as you listen to today's devotional, things are finally making sense for you. You realize your heart has been far from God, and you'd like to be forgiven. You'd like to be made right with God and to know that you're headed for heaven. Well, you can begin this relationship with Jesus in a conversation right now at 888-NEED-HIM. 888-NEED-HIM. Thanks for listening today to The Land and the Book. Our host, Dr. Charlie Dyer, our producer, Dan Anderson. I'm John Gager, and we point you to our website as always. It's thelandandthebook.org. Join us next time for another edition of The Land and the Book, a production of Moody Radio, a ministry of Moody Bible Institute.